Thanks for tuning in for the September 20th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. In our What's Trending segment, Dr. Winston Chong will talk about the updated AAN position statement on ethical considerations in dementia diagnosis and care. This week's feature interview is with Dr. Emily Edmonds, and she will discuss a study where she and her colleagues identified cognitive subgroups in participants in the ADRC who did not have dementia using auctorial methods and examines how their cognitive biomarker neuropathological profile changed over time.
Hi, it's Jeff Ratliff with Jefferson University and the Neurology Podcast. Welcome to this week's What's Trending interview. This week, I'm joined by Winston Chong from the University of California, San Francisco. Winston is the lead author from an AAN position statement publication in the July 20th issue of Neurology titled Ethical Considerations in Dementia Diagnosis and Care. This publication is from the Ethics, Law, and Humanities Committee, which is a joint committee of the AAN, the American Neurological Association, and the Child Neurology Society. In this position statement, Winston and his fellow authors provide guidance and context for a number of ethical considerations that we need to keep in mind in the care of patients with a variety of diseases that cause dementia. From an ethical standpoint, dementia presents a number of challenges with regards to our core bioethical principles, such as the example you mentioned where we need to balance the respect for our patient's autonomy with the reality of worsening capacity to make informed medical decisions. So Winston, thanks for joining us on the Neurology Podcast to discuss this position statement.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here, and I look forward to the conversation.
I want to preface this discussion by informing our listeners that this position statement really covers a wide breadth of clinical scenarios and considerations, and we really don't have the time within a podcast interview to cover the entirety of what you and the committee authors covered. I'm hoping we can dive into some specific examples and scenarios and would encourage our listeners who do care for patients with dementia to go back to the July issue of Neurology and find the publication itself. So to start off, Winston, you mentioned early in the piece that even the nomenclature here may be evolving with regards to the term dementia itself, citing that some of our patients or families may find the term offensive or even derogatory. In our efforts to communicate diagnoses to patients and their families, what pitfalls should we be aware of when it comes to our terminology?
Well, I'll start by saying that a diagnosis of dementia or of Alzheimer's disease just in itself can be painful and frightening to receive. But on top of that, we sometimes create confusion with the language we use. This is partly a matter of how unsettled the science is. Different scientists and clinicians might use a term like Alzheimer's disease to mean a clinical syndrome, or a pathological process, or a degree of functional impairment. But sometimes also clinicians delay and beat around the bush because we're uncomfortable with the topic and we fall back on euphemisms or vague medicalese. We advise that when clinicians use labels like dementia and Alzheimer's disease, we have to have sensitivity. We should acknowledge that different experts or websites or other resources may use these terms in different ways than we do, and we have to clarify what we mean by them. It can also be important to explore and address misconceptions that people might have, like that dementia means that someone is crazy or psychotic. And overall, as a clinician, I hope that just speaking openly and empathetically about these terms can be one way we have of reducing stigma and shame.
And while we're on the topic of communicating, and especially communicating the diagnosis with patients and families, I want to give you a scenario where, let's say we're seeing a patient and preparing to deliver a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. But before we go into the room, a patient's son pulls us aside, requests of us that we spare the patient of telling them about any diagnosis of dementia, out of concern that they might have a severe emotional response to hearing such a diagnosis. How would you and your authors advise our listeners to navigate this sort of situation from an ethical context?
So we're really just diving into some of the toughest situations here, right? I'm going to start with the sort of dry ethical principles analysis, and then talk about how I see this working practically. Because I think sometimes clinicians can feel frustrated when they think that the ethical principles are really divorced from how things work out in practice. But at the level of principles and really the level of law, a key issue is whether the patient has decisional capacity, right? So if someone's going to be making decisions about their own care, then they need to have the information about their situation in order to exercise their autonomy. And while emotional harms are real, there are lots of other harms that depriving people of this information can lead to, like failures to do advanced care planning. On the other hand, if someone doesn't have decisional capacity anymore, then an appropriate surrogate can legitimately sometimes tell us what information should and shouldn't be shared with them. Although here, as a matter of respect, I think patients should usually receive their diagnoses if we can figure out the best way. So overall, this question partly illustrates the importance of capacity assessment, which is a topic we discuss at length in the statement. So getting back to the practical situation you raised, if someone is owed the truth, we do want to minimize harms. There are some helpful frameworks for communicating serious information that can be useful here. In our statement, we reference the SPIKES protocol. To some extent, I think that all neurologists, just given the nature of brain illness, should be experts in delivering serious information. But I think that we can use these frameworks and protocols as kind of a helpful structure for conversations that can help us to remember to include kind of all of these elements of delivering serious information that we've kind of picked up from our experience in watching other clinicians.
I think that's helpful. And I know I've encountered similar scenarios, and I hope everyone sort of feels a little better equipped to handle some of these tough situations. I want to switch to a different scenario regarding our patients who have dementia and their ability to continue to live at home with their caregivers. Another topic that you cover in this position statement is that a decision to transition patients to assisted living facilities or nursing homes can really be fraught with a number of ethical issues. So again, let's say we have a patient with dementia who's requiring a lot of supervision at home, and it's clearly straining the capabilities of the family members who are involved. But we also, again, let's say we have a son or a daughter of that patient who feels that they would be breaking a promise or letting their parent down by transitioning their care to a nursing home or other facility. What sort of things, principles, or ethical considerations do we need to keep in mind navigating that type of scenario?
Yeah, that's another tough one. Well, ethically, our first responsibility is to the patient. But as we discuss in the statement, dementia caregivers play a really critical role in clinical care. In a lot of cases, if you don't have a caregiver involved, you've really got nothing to go on, right? You have no history, you have no exam, you have no plan. So part of taking care of the patient is recognizing and trying to ameliorate caregiver burden, which often does result in bad outcomes for the patient. Now, as we say, decisions about placement are really complex. There are lifelong relationships and commitments involved, and often there are complicated cultural factors that we may not fully understand. So I'm not very prescriptive in these situations. And if a caregiver is really, really motivated to keep a patient at home, I try to offer advice and resources to make this as feasible as possible. And again, we have some examples and references for people to follow in the statement. But sometimes our perspectives as clinicians can be useful. Most caregivers are doing this for the first time ever, while as clinicians, we've often gotten to see how similar situations have played out in the past. So what I've done sometimes is just describe the situation as I see it, which sometimes can help caregivers to recognize when their expectations for themselves aren't reasonable, or just that placement in a nursing home isn't necessarily like a personal failing on their part.
I think that's super helpful and appreciate that practical advice, again, for a difficult but probably common scenario that our listeners are probably going to run into. The final thing I want to talk about is about disease-modifying therapies for neurocognitive disorders or dementia. And so across the spectrum of neurodegenerative diseases, those of us who see patients with these diseases are obviously hopeful that we're entering an era now of disease-modifying therapies becoming available. So as our listeners will recognize that the approval of aducanumab in June of this year may be the first of potentially many other drugs to come to market indicated for disease modification of a neurodegenerative disease. Without feeling the need to sort of specifically comment on aducanumab and speaking as an expert in neurodegenerative disease, what are the ethical considerations we need to keep in mind when it comes to discussing or choosing to prescribe possible disease-modifying therapies down the road as they become available?
So our statement was written and went through many layers of review at the AAN and ANA and even CNS and the journal, all before aducanumab was approved. So this statement doesn't directly address decisions about that drug or about hopefully more effective future treatments. However, our statement does give broad frameworks for thinking about important decisions in dementia, which I think do apply to this and other potential therapies. As one example, a major section of our statement addresses how we make decisions in different stages of dementia. In the case of aducanumab and other amyloid targeting treatments, these are probably going to need to be given in early stages to be effective at all. So in most cases, decisions about these treatments will be made with patients who still have capacity, and this is something that we talk about again in the statement. We also have a subsection in the position statement addressing awareness of financial strains in dementia. Now, given the cost of aducanumab and the fact that traditional Medicare only covers 80% of costs, Well, depending on what systems Medicare and CMS decide to put in place to handle out-of-pocket costs and systemic costs associated with this drug, this is something that we as clinicians may have to think a lot more about. Finally, there's an important subsection of our position statement about racial, ethnic, and other health disparities in dementia. And unfortunately here, the lack of inclusion of Black, Indigenous, and Hispanic patients in clinical trials of aducanumab is a very stark illustration of those disparities and something that our field really desperately needs to address going forward.
I think that's really helpful. And I think that, again, a lot of this hinges on the capacity of our patients and really having a solid assessment of their capacity and decision-making when we're starting to think about issues regarding autonomy, but as you said, also other ethical principles like justice and making sure that we're delivering care in a fair way, I think is really helpful to keep in mind. So thanks, Winston, for those insights.
Sure. I think we're entering a really exciting new time, but also really ethically challenging time in dementia care.
Precisely. And I think that was all really helpful. I hope our listeners come away feeling more informed about these ethical considerations for our patients with dementia. And Winston, before we wrap, I just wanted to thank you again for joining us on the podcast.
It's been great to be here. Thanks.
So I've been speaking with Winston Chong, the lead author on an AAN position statement titled Ethical Considerations in Dementia Diagnosis and Care. Again, that's from the July 20 issue of Neurology. And as I mentioned at the top of the interview, the article is rich with lots of scenarios, considerations, and resources for the gamut of care delivered to patients with dementia. So anyone who does care for these patients should really go back and check out this position statement. And as always, thanks for listening to the Neurology Podcast.
This is Greg Day from Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Emily Edmonds, a neuropsychologist and assistant professor at UC San Diego and VA San Diego Healthcare System. She's also the lead author on a paper published in this week's issue of Neurology titled Data-Driven versus Consensus Diagnosis of MCI, Enhanced Sensitivity for Detection of Dementia Progression, Biomarker Status, and Neuropathological Outcomes. Emily, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your paper addresses a big challenge facing clinicians and researchers who commonly assess patients with memory complaints. And really, that's how do we identify those patients who might have early symptoms of a disease like Alzheimer's disease or a related dementia? Although many different clinicians and many listening to this podcast will agree we can use different approaches to manage these patients, I think most of us work with pretty much the same toolbox, an assessment that begins with a thorough history from the patient and a knowledgeable family member, followed by some form of cognitive testing. In research, a common approach is, of course, to have participants undergo a very standardized clinical, neurological, and neuropsychological evaluation and then turn to a multidisciplinary team to render a diagnosis. And indeed, that's what your team did in this paper. What are the problems with this, we'll call it a gold standard consensus approach, and how does your work in this area potentially improve upon this tried and true methodology?
Right. So as you mentioned, in research studies, it's very common for a diagnosis of MCI, or mild cognitive impairment, to be based on a consensus diagnosis. And so this is where a team of experts will review the information that's known about someone and arrive at a diagnostic impression. The problem with this approach is essentially that there can be quite a bit of subjectivity that goes into it. So for one, it relies on the subjective report of the participant or the patient in terms of what cognitive symptoms they've noticed. And this subjective report has been shown to be inconsistently related to objective cognitive function. And then in addition, the final diagnosis is based on the consensus team's subjective impression and clinical judgment. And a potential drawback is that this method limits standardization across research labs or across clinics, since consensus teams may weigh certain information differently than others. So given this, my colleagues and I really tried to improve upon this method by using a data-driven approach to identify subgroups of MCI or cognitively normal. And this was based on participants' performance on objective neuropsychological testing. And so this data-driven method removes that subjectivity, which we know from previous studies can lead to misclassifications.
And this data set that you're referring to, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, includes 738 patients with baseline neuropsychological data and followed for an average of 5.9 years, a pretty robust group to be working with. What are your key findings using this data-driven approach?
That's right. This group of patients, so again, over 700 older adults that did not have dementia, and these were participants from the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at the University of California, San Diego. As part of that study, every individual completes neuropsych testing at baseline, and then they have annual follow-up visits. And the method we used to classify individuals was a cluster analysis. So this is a statistical method in which individuals are grouped together based on similarities in their performance on baseline cognitive testing across the various different cognitive domains assessed. And what we found is that the cluster analysis identified several different cognitive subgroups of both cognitively normal participants and those with MCI. So focusing on our MCI group, we found an amnestic MCI group that had impaired memory and language abilities. We found a non-amnestic group that had intact memory, but showed impaired abilities in other areas like executive function or visual spatial abilities. And then we had a mixed MCI group that had impairments in a number of those cognitive domains kind of across the board. And so once we identified those groups, we were then able to look at longitudinal data, again, collected over many years. And we saw that our subgroups were associated with differing rates of progression to dementia. So that cognitive performance at baseline was predictive of their risk of progression. Our next step, then, we looked at biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease. So we had a subset of the sample that had undergone lumbar puncture for collection of cerebral spinal fluid, or CSF. And these samples were analyzed for certain proteins that are seen in Alzheimer's disease. And we had a subset of participants that were followed over time and eventually had passed away and came to autopsy. So we were able to look at neuropathology. And what we found were differences between our neuropsychological groups in terms of CSF biomarkers and the severity of Alzheimer's disease at autopsy. And then lastly, when we compared our cognitive groups, again, these groups are based just on neuropsychological test scores alone. When we compared those groups to participants' original consensus diagnosis, we found that the two didn't always correspond. And our longitudinal data showed that the neuropsychological method tended to capture a greater proportion of individuals who progressed relative to the consensus method.
So there's a lot to unpack there, and thank you for that summary. But first, let me start with a follow-up question here. I think most of us are familiar with amnestic MCI, and many have heard about non-amnestic MCI. What does mixed MCI mean in your cohort, this group that seemed to be perhaps uniquely at risk for dementia progression?
Yeah, great question. So these were individuals that came into the study with multi-domain cognitive impairments. So the domains that we looked at were learning and memory, attention, executive function, language abilities, and visual spatial abilities. And the scores that we used in our cluster analysis were standardized scores that were corrected for demographics, so age, education, and sex. And so this group of individuals was performing in the impaired range, so well below average across all those different domains of functioning. So certainly a more at-risk group.
And using your algorithm to identify these mixed group of individuals with multi-domain impairment, you showed that the mixed MCI group in particular had the shortest time to dementia and the highest risk of progressing to dementia. Why do you think that that's the case in this unique cohort?
So I think that's the case because these individuals, I believe, were in a later stage of the disease or a more advanced stage of MCI. So this mixed group was about 10% of the sample. And again, in addition to their multi-domain impairments, they also had the highest rate of CSF biomarker positivity, in addition to, as you mentioned, greater progression to dementia over time. So I think we're capturing these individuals at a later stage in the disease process.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that summary. The data-driven approach also seemed to classify a lot more participants with MCI than the consensus approach, about 30% more, I think, when compared to your panel of experts. And as a result, your data shows that this cohort or cluster analysis approach labeled 66% of participants who progressed to dementia as MCI at baseline, which was an improvement on the 55% that were classified by the consensus approach. Now, this is a good thing if we assume that the focus in our clinic assessments is on developing or implementing the most sensitive detection tool, and I think that's definitely the focus of your work. But for those of us in practice, we could conclude it's a bad thing if we're incorrectly labeling cognitively normal individuals as being cognitively impaired, so what we might call false positives. How many participants were classified by the cluster analysis as impaired at baseline but didn't actually progress to dementia over the follow-up period?
So this is the challenge, right? Because we want to develop methods that do capture people early in the disease process, you know, especially for the purpose of enrolling individuals in clinical trials that are aimed to prevent or delay progression. But at the same time, you're right, we don't want to overdiagnose. And my colleagues and I have done a series of studies actually prior to this one where we did focus in on that false positive question and looked at the factors that contribute to errors in that direction. With the consensus diagnosis, though, it did seem to be the main concern was underdiagnosis of MCI. And therefore, our data-driven method did indeed diagnose more people with MCI. And, you know, it's not perfect. And certainly in doing so, there is a risk that we may have introduced some false positive errors. But we do believe this was outweighed by the increased sensitivity and the ability to identify these different subgroups of MCI that do seem to represent different stages or different levels of risk. And in the paper, we do include a figure that shows the number of individuals that progress to dementia at each follow-up visit. And so from this, you can tell how many have progressed, how many did not progress, as well as how many were not included at each time point, either because they were lost to follow-up or they hadn't been in the study long enough.
And I want to call attention to, I think, the point that you just made, that we do place an emphasis on the early detection of clinical symptoms that might point to an underlying syndrome of Alzheimer's disease. And I think we do that because our patients do and their caregivers do. That's, I guess, usually the reason that they're in our office. As well, I think the new news about potential changes in how we treat this disease or new options for treatment also further exemplifies the need to recognize these patients early on. What do you think about the potential to see a system like this, a data-driven approach used in clinic that exemplifies non-invasive metrics based on neuropsychological testing to potentially identify patients that might be at risk, and then a follow-up, maybe using a more specific measure, some disease-specific biomarkers to really hone in on those patients that are true positives? Would something like that be a practical consideration?
Yes. Yeah. I think when you think about bringing this method to the clinic, one thing that's important to keep in mind is just that, as you said, this neuropsychological method has been shown to be a powerful tool in terms of being cost-effective and non-invasive and a way for clinicians to collect objective data about their patients. You know, our work has shown that the subjective report of functioning and measures like clinical dementia rating scales tend to be weighed more heavily than objective testing when coming to a diagnosis. But this line of work has really shown that using those neuropsychologically defined MCI subtypes can show stronger associations with biomarkers and with eventual clinical outcomes.
In the time that we have left, could you reflect a little bit more on some of the potential practical applications of these findings in your research cohort? Specifically, what advice might you have for some of the clinicians who are listening to this podcast and are really looking for ways to innovate or improve the diagnostic process in their clinic?
So the main recommendation I would make is just, you know, to whatever extent clinicians are able to refer patients for a comprehensive neuropsychological evaluation. And importantly, this is above and beyond brief cognitive screening measures that are often used, like the MMSE or the MoCA. It's beneficial to get this more comprehensive data and to incorporate that into diagnosis. These are data that look at different domains of functioning, as I said, that are sometimes overlooked by those screening measures.
And I think your findings and discussion about MCI subtypes also exemplifies, you know, perhaps the need to further stratify patients based on those interpretations, with the mixed cohort, the multi-domain impaired cohort, maybe being those most in need of further evaluations that potentially could include some of those clinically available biomarkers.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I think one advantage of our approach is the ability to separate that mixed MCI group from our amnestic MCI group. If we had restricted our groups to the more conventional labels that are usually used to describe MCI, then our amnestic and our mixed group would have been collapsed together since both showed memory impairment. But there does seem to be utility in these more nuanced subgroups that separate those groups from one another, since they did appear to represent earlier and later stages of the disease process.
Emily, why do you think it's so important to ensure an accurate diagnosis early in the symptomatic course of these patients?
Yeah, so an accurate diagnosis is important since it's this early period when interventions or prevention efforts are likely to be most effective. So, you know, this may include interventions such as lifestyle changes or better management of vascular risk factors or treatment with medications. So in a clinic setting, you know, an inaccurate diagnosis could lead to missed opportunities for this type of intervention or treatment. And then, of course, on the other hand, giving a diagnosis if it's not warranted can have negative psychological consequences and may lead to the potential for inappropriate or unnecessary medication use. Also, when thinking about a research setting, accurate diagnosis is so important for enrolling participants in research trials or in clinical trials. So including too many false positives in your MCI sample or including too many false negatives in your healthy control sample. So either of these types of errors can have the effect of washing out significant findings that might actually be there and can make it more difficult to detect potentially meaningful treatment effects.
As good as this study is, like all the studies that we do, it has some limitations. What are the most important ones that you think our readers should be paying attention to?
I think a key limitation when we're talking about practical applications is that our participant sample was largely white and well-educated. And so this is important just because as we continue to develop and refine these data-driven algorithms and apply them to the clinic, it'll be critical to conduct additional research looking at the utility of these methods in more diverse samples. And that will really help increase the generalizability of our findings to the patients that clinicians are actually seeing in their office.
Emily, thank you for taking the time to discuss your findings.
Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Emily Edmonds, lead author on the paper, Data-Driven versus Consensus Diagnosis of MCI, Enhanced Sensitivity for Detection of Dementia Progression, Biomarker Status, and Neuropathological Outcomes. This is an article that you can and should read in this week's issue of Neurology.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interview investigating the relation of neuropsychiatric symptoms to cognitive function in individuals with Alzheimer's disease, as well as a contemporary issues article describing the unethical framework for conducting artificial intelligence research in neurology. You will find these and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.